What is a painting? The image of the subject? The style of the artist? Hi, my name's Jean Dalmermuth, and as a paintings conservator, I see them as physical objects, how they're made, and everything that's happened to them since. Let me show you what I see, and you'll never look at a painting the same way again.
Now that you know how early Italian paintings were generally made, I want to look at one single painting from that time. And I'm going to do that over two episodes. This one about how it was made and its life up until about 60 years ago. And then the next episode will be about what's happened to it since then. It's a crucifix painted in the second half of the 13th century, so about 750 years ago. And it's currently displayed in the sacristy of the Basilica of Santa Croce in Florence. It's very large, 14.5 feet, or about 4.5 meters high, and it hangs about that high off the ground, so you necessarily see it from a distance. You can't get up close to see the details. So first, you notice the size and shape. The painting has a real sculptural quality to it, because like many early Italian paintings, it's not rectangular. It's identifiably a crucifix, primarily made up of one fairly narrow vertical piece, crossed by a horizontal one about a quarter of the way down. And then, in addition to that basic cross shape, it has some extra rectangular bits. At the top of the vertical member is a rectangle, wider than it is tall, so what would be called landscape-shaped. At either end of the horizontal member, the support expands out into portrait-shaped rectangles, taller than they are wide. Below the level of the horizontal member, the vertical one widens out in what's called an apron. Then below that narrows again, then widens out again in a smaller rectangle, then narrows again. At the crossing of the two main elements, there's a three-dimensional semicircle that tilts forward. And all of that shape, outlined by a raised molding, is constructed of a wooden panel. The subject depicted is the crucifixion, the central moment or a central moment, that's a theological debate, not a material one, of Christianity, when Jesus Christ was executed by being nailed to a cross. But being an early Italian painting, this is a symbolic as much as a realistic depiction. The body of the crucified Christ is modeled with highlights and shadows to give a feeling of being three-dimensional, with the light seeming to come from almost directly above, catching on the figure's closed eyelids and the proper left collarbone. He wears a loincloth that's almost a translucent veil, not like an actual garment that might have been worn by a condemned prisoner. He's nailed through his palms to a cross that isn't brown like wood, but instead a deep blue, and that's bordered with bands of gold and a narrowed patterned ribbon. Blood from Christ's wounds drips down across the blue and puddles on those bands as if they were raised moldings. Behind that cross, the apron doesn't show a landscape as if this event were actually happening outside, but instead is decorated with a geometric pattern which looks like a black trellis on a reddish ground. Christ's body, wider than the blue cross itself, slumps to the left out across that area. In the rectangles at either end of the horizontal member are half-length figures, Mary the Mother of Jesus on the left and the Apostle John on the right. They're smaller in scale than the central figure, and they wear clothes painted in muted tones of plum and rose that are edged with mordant gilding. The rectangle at the top of the vertical member is red and has an inscription on it that reads in Latin, "This is Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews." That inscription is now really hard to read. It's hard to tell, but it's likely done with mordant gilding. The small rectangle near the bottom of the vertical member, at the level of Christ's feet, is blue like the main cross. What's also noticeable when you see the painting now is that large portions of the image are a fuzzy neutral tone, slightly lighter than the surrounding paint, and the forms don't continue across these areas. You can absolutely recognize the image, but you still realize that there's something else going on here. the way this painting looks now is the sum total of how it was made and all of the changes that have happened to it since. Before I start telling its story, I need to express thanks to two people for sharing their insights with me, Annika Finna and Laura Brucke. Both are conservators with broad interests and deep expertise, particularly concerning paintings like this one. Finna is getting a doctorate in art history, and her research is focused on restorations and changes made to early paintings, what she refers to as collaborations across time. Brucke is an artist who not only uses traditional techniques in modern ways, but has also translated an edition of Cennino Cennini's Il Libro dell'Arte. Annika and Laura, thank you both. In all likelihood, this was a long time ago, so the facts aren't absolutely certain. This crucifix was painted by an artist called Cimabue. He lived mostly in Florence between about 1240 and 1302. Cimabue is a nickname, meaning bullhead, and lots of people in Florence have nicknames. His real name was Cenni di Pepo, Pepo being his father's first name. At this point, only aristocrats had family names. Everyone else was identified with their father's first name, preceded by D, meaning of. But everyone called him Cimabue. So I'm going to refer throughout this episode to this painting as the Cimabue Crucifix, even though, as we'll see, he painted other crucifixes as well, and at least one other survives. Cimabue probably taught many craftsmen in his workshop over his career, but the best known of them was Giotto. Both were famous enough in their time to rate a mention in Dante's Divine Comedy, written in the early 14th century. And that mention is a commentary about how fleeting fame is. In an English translation, in painting, Cimabue thought he held the field, but now it's Giotto has the cry, so that the other's fame is dimmed. Nevertheless, 700 years later, we're still talking about both of them. Something as large and elaborate as the Cimabue crucifix was certainly made to commission. Once the contract between painter and patron was settled, the wooden support would have been made. The craftsmanship is impressive. Not including the molding along the edges, there were originally 15 separate pieces of poplar wood that were used to form the elaborate shape. The horizontal member is actually made of two planks of wood. The halo was made of wedges of wood carefully shaped into a semicircle. The support was reinforced on the reverse with cross battens of elm. Iron nails were pounded through the front to secure the main panel to the battens. Then the nail heads were covered with plugs so that the iron wouldn't rust and stay in the ground and paint layers. Next came the ground layer, which you can't see because it's sandwiched between the panel support and the paint. Now, do you remember back in episode 6 about the ground layer in early Italian paintings? I mentioned that sometimes, before the gesso was applied to a wooden panel, a painter might first glue a layer of canvas onto that panel. That was done with the Cimabue crucifix. Canvas was solidly adhered over the whole panel with animal glue, making a continuous layer over all the carpentry joins. And then the gesso was applied over that. So to be clear, the support is panel. The canvas is part of how that panel was prepared. But that canvas layer will turn out to be important because it helped much of the paint layer survive in the second half of this story. After the gesso was smoothed, the water gilding was applied, and then the paint. So a few things about that paint layer. Although it's usually just mentioned in passing, most crucifixes of this era, by Cimabue and other artists, have blue crosses. Why blue? It seems, and this is something I asked Annika Finna, who would know, that no one has really explored this question. It may be that it's just as obvious as a gold background. Blue places this event out of time and space. This isn't a historical event, but a metaphysical one. Blue is not only precious, but the color of the heavens. I haven't been able to find technical information about which blue pigment was used for the Cimabue crucifix, but in other related ones, it's ultramarine, that most expensive of colors that had to be imported as a stone from Afghanistan and then laboriously transformed into a bright blue pigment, which seems incredibly extravagant. But for one thing, the price of ultramarine fluctuated, and this era, the second half of the 13th century, may have been a time when it was less expensive. The Mongol Empire, under Chinggis Khan and his descendants, opened up trade routes, collectively called the Silk Road, that were traveled by Franciscan missionaries, Marco Polo and his family, and caravans of goods, including those extravagant textiles depicted in so many early Italian paintings, and the raw material of ultramarine. Another thing to think about is how much pigment would actually be needed. One of the conservators I thanked earlier, Laura Brucca, created a modern replica of a different Cimabue crucifix, one that's now in Arezzo. She made that replica while she was a student at the Hamilton Carr Institute, one of the leading conservation training programs in the UK. The original crucifix has a blue cross. For her copy, Brucca used azurite rather than ultramarine, exactly for reasons of cost. The blue cross of the original is in fact painted with ultramarine. One interesting thing Brucca found in making this copy is that a surprisingly little amount of blue pigment was needed. So perhaps using ultramarine wasn't quite as extravagant as we think. In her copy, Brucca painted the colors of that other Cimabue crucifix as they originally were, before centuries muted some of them by fading or darkening. And when she saw the finished result, she made the observation, one that echoes something written by art historian Umberto Baldini, who will be important to the story of the Cimabue crucifix at Santa Croce, that contrasted against the rich blue of the cross, the body of Christ, painted only in humble earth colors, underpainted in that dull green earth, is, as she puts it, startling in its simplicity. And that effect may have been exactly what the painter intended, but it's lost a lot of its impact over time, both because the colors have altered and because we see and understand colors differently. We're used to having lots of bright colors all the time. The 13th century viewer wasn't. The body contrasts too with the geometric pattern on the apron. That pattern is visually behind the blue cross, and it's also typical of crucifixes of this era. In fact, it represents a patterned textile. That was discussed in that same exhibition I referenced in episode 9 about early Italian paintings and textiles, the exhibition that identified the actual textiles that painters were imitating. The curators of that exhibition point out the similarity of the patterns used in painted crucifixes to textiles woven in then Islamic Spain. Interlocked geometrical shapes, diamonds, that is, squares standing on one corner, crosses, stars, and other shapes. They fit together like ceramic tiles, so that, as it were, the shapes between the shapes create their own shapes. Like the textiles they represent, the patterned textiles on crucifixes might use multiple colors or only two, at which point they look like a trellis pattern on a solid background. Annika Finna explained to me that the textile depicted in the painting may relate to real textiles displayed within the church at the time, possibly particularly cloths on the altar. While the arrangement of altars has changed a lot over the intervening centuries, you can think of an altar as a table, generally covered with a cloth that can be more or less elaborate. There's an image of a geometrically patterned textile on an altar in a fresco by Giotto, that student of Cimabue's who himself worked at Santa Croce. That resemblance between the painted and the real textiles created a kind of symbolic link between the body of Christ on the cross and the body of Christ in the form of the consecrated host on the altar. In all likelihood, The Cimabue crucifix was made for the church that still owns it today, the Basilica of Santa Croce in Florence. This church belongs to the Franciscans, the religious order founded by St. Francis of Assisi. It's an enormous space, longer than a football field, the largest Franciscan church in the world. Santa Croce is dedicated to the true cross, that is, the actual cross on which Christ was crucified. And the church has a relic of what are said to be fragments of this cross. Now, just to complicate things, but don't worry about it too much, the Cimabue crucifix may well have been painted before the construction of the present basilica began, but there has been a Franciscan church on this location since 1228. And that location, which is going to turn out to be key to the second half of the story, is just north of the Arno River that runs through the city of Florence, which is in a valley surrounded by hills. Currently in the sanctuary of Santa Croce, there's a different, slightly later crucifix that hangs above the altar, suspended from the ceiling. The Cimabue crucifix could have hung like that, but more likely it stood on top of a tramezzo, a wall cutting across the sanctuary, which divided the main part of the church, where the congregation stood, from the high altar where the priest said Mass. In English, this type of structure is called a rood screen, R-O-O-D, meaning a crucifix, which was often displayed on top of it. This tramezzo, the Italian word, would maybe be a story or so high, not going all the way up to the soaring ceiling, really a dividing wall or a screen with a gated door in the middle. So a crucifix could stand on top of it, maybe braced with a kind of tripod. The monumental scale of the Cimabue crucifix matched the huge size of the church. There's an image of such an arrangement in another fresco by Giotto. In that depiction, we're on the far side of the tramezzo, the side where the priest said Mass, and we can see the back of a crucifix that's on top of the tramezzo, so the front faces the congregation. From our vantage point, we can see the carpentry of the support. And the references to these frescoes by Giotto is another thing I need to thank Annika Finna for. The crucifix depicted in the fresco leans forward, and in fact, the way the Cimabue crucifix is displayed today, it leans a bit forward. One effect that creates is that the head of Christ, painted on that raised halo, seems to fall forward and into the space of the viewer. Today, the interior of Santa Croce looks very different, because the tramezzo was dismantled in 1566 to be in line with changes in the liturgy. Architecture, like paintings, gets changed over time. The Cimabue crucifix was likely in the main sanctuary of Santa Croce for decades, even centuries, although it may have been moved around a bit. It was seen by generations, meaning also by generations of artists, beginning with Cimabue's student Giotto. It's been regarded as the beginning of what would become the Renaissance. It has a relative, compared to earlier paintings, naturalism and illusion of three-dimensionality, and a sense of the humanity as well as the divinity of Christ, things that would become more important over time. Giorgio Vasari, the 16th century painter and writer, called the Cimabue crucifix the first page of Italian art. But as the pages turned, it was eventually considered old-fashioned and removed from its prime location. But it was always kept by the Franciscan friars. Over the centuries, many things happened to it. While the crucifix escaped damage from the major floods of the Arno in 1333 and 1557, when it may still have been high on the tramezzo, it apparently fell more than once. Those falls resulted in fairly minor paint loss that was disguised within painting. New paint added over a loss to make it blend in with the original and not be distracting. Almost any painting with any age to it has some amount of paint loss. Sometimes you might be surprised how much, because it's been disguised within painting. For many people, that's considered part of caring for a painting, treating it with respect so it doesn't look injured. There were also other campaigns of restoration, including, and I put this word in quotes, cleanings. I don't really like that word because it's both ambiguous and loaded. What it basically means is the removal of unwanted material. But that material can be a variety of things, be unwanted for a variety of reasons, and be removed in a variety of ways. Cleaning can mean just the removal of dust and grime, which is fairly simple, and I would call that surface cleaning. But generally when people refer to the cleaning of paintings, they mean varnish removal, which is much more involved. Varnishes, and I'll talk more about them in a later episode, are clear coatings that are put over a paint layer. The functions of a varnish are to saturate the paint colors, even out the gloss, and provide a surface to interact with the atmosphere. So, for example, if you're surface cleaning a varnished painting, you're removing dirt from the surface of the varnish, not the paint. Oftentimes, a varnish is considered a sacrificial layer that can be removed and replaced when needed. Ideally, a varnish is chemically different enough from the paint that the removal can be done without harming the paint at all. Why remove a varnish? Because over time, most varnishes go from being clear and relatively colorless to being yellow, even brown, and a bit sort of frosted. The overall color tone of the painting looks yellower, but also the light colors look darker than they originally did, and simultaneously, the dark colors look lighter, so the forms get flattened out. When those changes are deemed to have gone too far, the decision might be made to remove that varnish and replace it. But that's always a decision, a subjective one. Meanwhile, the word cleaning generally has positive connotations. Clean is generally a good thing, implying health, wealth, morality, and modernity. Sometimes I'll hear people say, "That painting needs a good cleaning." And it sounds to me something like, "That child needs a good spanking." Don't get me wrong, I'm all for varnish removal in the right circumstance, and I've done a lot of it myself. But it should always be a decision. At any rate, restorers working on the Cimabue crucifix over the centuries had likely removed and replaced varnishes, which are mostly plant resins, multiple times. They had also added other materials to the painting, including glues, waxes, and synthetic resins. Those were likely applied to help hold together the different layers, as over time, the physical and chemical bonds between them weaken. Probably in connection with those varnish removals and replacements, there had also been a certain amount of overpainting. That can be different from what I would call inpainting, which is limited to the actual areas of paint loss. Overpainting, on the other hand, is when original paint is covered up with new paint, maybe with the intent of deliberately changing how it originally looked. Changing colors, making them brighter or more muted, changing the features of a face, or the type of clothing a figure wears. There was some of that that happened here. It's a bit unclear how much. Also, over the centuries, two parts of the original support were taken off. There was originally a circular-shaped piece, called a tondo, at the very top. There's a slot into which it would have fit. That probably showed an image of God the Father, or maybe Christ the Redeemer, something like what the Cimabue crucifix in Arezzo still has. At the bottom, there would have been a trapezoidal piece that supported the crucifix on the tramezzo, just like in the fresco by Giotto. In other crucifixes, that's sometimes painted as a rocky landscape, a suggestion of Golgotha, the site of the actual crucifixion. Meanwhile, at some point, an iron framework was added to the reverse. It's unclear if that was actually necessary or if that was just done as a kind of precaution, maybe overthinking things a bit. That framework weighed 210 kilograms, more than 450 pounds. By the 19th century, the Cimabue crucifix had been moved to the museum of the church, in the former refectory, the dining hall where the Franciscans had their meals. And that's where it hung in November of 1966. which is where we'll pick up the story next time. As always, you can see images of the paintings I've talked about on my website, jeandahmermuth.com/podcast, and that address is also in the podcast description. I hope you'll take a look.
The music you hear is 1600 in Vienna by Sujay Govindaraj, and I found it on Tribe of Noise. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.